I'll now invite our brother Greg forward to give us the necessary words of exhortation.
Morning, brothers and sisters. The bricks that Israel made in Egypt were somewhat unique in that they used straw. Nowhere else at that time did they use straw. They were generally baked, but the Egyptians didn't have an abundance of fuel to fuel the kilns. So they found another way, and that was to put the straw in. Whenever I thought about the straw being in there, I've thought of it sort of like we put rebar in cement. You know, that's sort of strengthen it. You know, you have strands going like this, and it's going to strengthen it. But that's not how it worked at all. It apparently there was a fermenting, and there was an acid that was given off, and I've got it written down somewhere. I think it's humic acid is released, and it actually makes the bricks three times as strong as without. And it's I've got a list. The archaeologists made some of these bricks recently, and it's interesting going through exactly how they did it to see what Israel did at that time. It was also pointed out that it's interesting just the veracity of the Bible, that there is just in one spot in all that known Middle East that used the straw. If this was written by somebody in Babylon, well, of course they kill their bricks. And if you remember in the Bible, it says when they're building the Tower of Babel, they made these bricks and baked them thoroughly. So anybody that was sort of, you know, throwing together, well, you know, let's make this book or whatever, they're going to get it wrong because their perspective was different than what happened in Egypt. So how were these made? First of all, the archaeologists used chaff and short lengths of straw. And they actually had a picture there of some of these old bricks that were made. And you can see the little holes where the straw had rotted and left these holes in the bricks. You can see that now. So anyways, they cut them up short, and they used chaff as well. And they kneaded it with their feet. Of course, they, you know, put these two mixtures together, the silt and the clay and the straw and the chaff, and put it in there along with water. And they kneaded it for 4 days. Now, I had no idea that was involved in it. So they're in there, you know, up to their ankles, going 4 days long, kneading this. And, of course, at that time, they had a pharaoh that absolutely hated them and made their work far harder. They had to go and get their straw themselves, right, and put it together there. So you can imagine all the work that was involved in this and spending all that time just kneading this. And then you leave it for a couple of days, and then you get your forms prepared or whatever, and the brick size, they have a uniform form, and they knead it once more, and then they pour it. And then they wait a minimum, they said, of 20 minutes, and it's starting to solid up. They put it on a floor where they put sand and a bit of straw on it so it doesn't stick to the floor, and they let it dry out and bake in the sun. And I guess I'm coming up with all these details because we know the story of Israel coming out of Egypt, and they wanted to go back there. And they were dying of exhaustion, kneading the clay and the straw and the chaff. And we know what the chaff is. You know, when you're bringing in your crops and you're taking the grain off and you got this leftover, it's worthless. You burn it up. And with straw, it also talks in the Bible, that's going to be burnt up in the end times. God is a consuming fire. We know the uselessness of that. And what the soil, we're made from the dust of the ground. And so all these allusions back to the ground, to the futility of doing it. And they had this wonderful promise, and they wanted to go back, because things were a little better back there in their minds. Another verse talking about we're made of the dust of the ground as that came to mind was the one that was in 1 Corinthians chapter 15. It says, the first man is from the earth, earthy. The second man is from heaven. As is the earthy, so also is those who are earthy. And as is the heavenly, so also are those who are heavenly. They were being given a choice of the heavenly, and they chose, they had the desire to go back to the earthy. So why am I focusing on these bricks they made? Because this may be my last exhort here. My first exhort ever was Psalm 40, and it talks about the miry clay. Our readings this morning, you pick it up in Psalm 69, several times it talked about the miry clay. And I'm just going, I don't think I fully developed it in my first exhort. So let's just turn up Psalm 40, do a little multitasking here, and also Psalm 69. And just compare the two of them, and because I'd like to establish a pattern and back up what I've been saying here. Because if we first look at Psalm 40, it says, verse 1, I waited patiently for the Lord. He inclined to me and heard my cry. He brought me up out of the pit of destruction, out of the miry clay. And if we look back to what I was saying prior to how Israel is, you know, up to their knees in this miry clay. He set my foot upon a rock, making my footsteps firm. He put a new song in my mouth, a song of praise. And of course, that's what our first reading was in Exodus 15. It was a song of Moses, and they're celebrating the fact that they had been saved out of the Red Sea, and that they had been saved out of the land. And so they sang this new song. So it applies fairly nicely to that. Now, the pit is, it says pit of destruction in my version, and we it equals really the grave. Let's just turn over then to verse 69, or to Psalm 69. And it, in verse 2, I have sunk in deep mire, and there is no foothold. Well, that goes right back to what we just read in verse 2. He set my foot upon a rock, made my footsteps firm. His footsteps weren't too firm earlier. Verse 2, I have come into deep waters, and the flood overflows me. I am weary with crying, my throat is parched. This isn't just, when I read that, I'm thinking, well, you know, crying tears, but when you think about the throat parched, so I looked up the word, and it's actually crying out. It's crying aloud, which goes back to Psalm 40, where it says, verse 1, he inclined to me and heard my cry. So it's a crying out. My throat is parched. It's dry from crying out. My eyes fail me while I wait for my God, verse 3. Go down to verse 14. We're in 69 still. Deliver me from the mire. So I waited patiently for the Lord. He inclined to me, heard my cry. I waited, deliver me from the mire. Do not let me sink. May I be delivered from my foes and from the deep waters. May the flood of waters not overflow me, and may the deep not swallow me up, and may the pit not shut its mouth on me. So there's this appeal to deliver. There's the mire. There's the pit. So we get these two things happening. Now, what's added in Psalm 69, which has numerous allusions to Christ in the New Testament, what's added, which you may have noticed, is talks about these deep waters. And I would say that would be, it's representative of death. The Egyptian army, when they're flooded by the deep waters, the flood, the deep waters. Jonah, when he was in the whale's belly for 3 days, as Christ was in the belly of the earth, it represented death. And of course, we get baptized. We go down into the water. We're dying to the old man and coming up the new man. So it sort of adds to the pit is death in these deep waters and being overwhelmed. I could go forward and go, how does this work out in the relationship with Christ? Because he certainly didn't get mired in sin, but you wonder whether the overwhelming, I've taken a step too far here, but Revelation 17 and 15 talks about the waters which you saw, peoples, multitudes, nations, and I can't read my writing, and tongues. That this multitude was overwhelming on Christ. That could be the illusion there. But anyways, back to my point that these sort of set a pattern for what we have in Israel coming out of Egypt. Now I want to take you forward, and we go to the New Testament, and we go to Judas Iscariot, and to give away the punchline. He's the money that he makes, that he gives back, it goes towards a potter's field, and he's buried in a potter's field. And a potter's field, of course, it's cheap land because it's clay. It's not really usable. Well, guess what? It's clay. Well, you could make bricks out of that. It's just, I don't know. It works for me that we have someone that was, let's think about Judas Iscariot. He was baptized. He was chosen as one of the 12. He was sent out. He had the ability to heal. He was sent out with the other 12 without anything, right? And yet we find him 6 days before the Passover, where Christ is crucified, in the house of Lazarus, and Martha's there, and Mary takes an expensive ointment called, it says nard in mine, pure nard, spikenard, and applies it to his feet, Jesus' feet. And the whole house is filled with the perfume. And this was a very expensive thing. And Judas Iscariot goes, well, we should have sold that and put that in the bag for the poor. But then it goes on to say, well, Judas Iscariot didn't really care about the poor. He just wanted the money in there because he was taking money out of it on his own. And then, of course, we know he's the betrayal that he makes of Christ. And he gets 30 pieces of silver for this betrayal. I'm just racing through here, but, you know, sometimes just giving the overall plan sometimes helps, and you fill in the pieces later. So he's got 30 pieces of silver, only he finds out that Christ is condemned, and he goes, well, just a minute, I didn't want that. I've sinned, so here, take back your 30 pieces of silver. And it was the priests who had give it to him, and the priests go, no, that's blood money, no. So Judas, and it struck me this time, he takes those 30 pieces of silver and he throws them into the sanctuary. And I'm guessing that would be, well, where the priests do their business with the showbread, with the candlestick, with and the incense, and 30 pieces of silver rattling off the ground, maybe even hitting these things as well. And he did it. He was mad. But he says, you know, you're taking it back. And I don't know, I was going to say ring of something. But the sound and the business of, you know, with Christ dying, that was basically the end of the sanctuary, the point of the sanctuary, you know, of it being of any value. And so the chief priests, they go, well, this is blood money. You know, we can't put that. They had high morals, you know. We can't take that money and just put it in the collection. No. So then they went out and bought this potter's field. And then how does he die? Well, there's one rendition that he hangs himself. But there's another one in Acts. I think it's in the first chapter of Acts, or the second, that he stumbles and falls headlong, and his innards basically come out, and they say it happens at the field of blood, but really the potter's field is called the field of blood because it came with this blood money, the 30 pieces of silver. Anyways, I don't know which one, and I'm not going to argue which one is correct. But it's really interesting that he stumbled, because come with me to Psalm 106 and 107, or 105 and 106, they basically cover Israel coming out of Egypt. And we're not going to go through all the plagues. We know that, and we don't have time. But verse 26 of Psalm 105 says, "He sent Moses his servant and Aaron whom he had chosen. They performed his wondrous acts among them and the miracles in the land of Ham." And then verse 37, "Then he brought them out with silver and gold, and among his tribes there was not one that stumbled." And when you look at the numbers, if you go to the book of Numbers, you find out that there was over 600,000 men over 20 that were brought up out of Egypt. So you include their wives and their children, and most people come up with about 2.5 million people came out of Egypt through the Red Sea, and not one of them stumbled. "Put my foot upon a rock and held my footstep firm." If we put our trust in God, we will not stumble. Whereas, of course, we have Judas Iscariot. I like the one. He stumbled, died. So, going on in Psalm 106, "Our fathers in Egypt did not understand thy wonders." And I guess where I'm going with this is, was this their downfall? Is this what we should be looking at? The wonders that have got us to the point that we are here, that we are at this table. "They did not remember," and this is a table of remembrance, remember? "They did not remember thine abundant kindness." And that's why we're here. We remember the abundance kindness of our Father. "But they rebelled by the sea," at the Red Sea. And I thought that was a really interesting word. I'm not going to go into it right now, but they rebelled before they came across the Red Sea. They rebelled there. "Nevertheless, he saved them for the sake of his name, that he might make his power known. Thus he rebuked the Red Sea, and it dried up, and he led them through the deeps as through the wilderness. So he saved them from the hand of the one who hated them, and redeemed them from the hand of the enemy, and the waters covered their adversaries. Not one of them was left. Then they believed his words." they sang his praise. And that's what we had in Exodus 15, the song of Moses. They sang his praise. Unfortunately, verse 13, they quickly forgot his works. They did not wait for his counsel. In other words, you know, Psalm 40, they waited patiently for the Lord. They did not wait for his counsel, but craved intensely in the wilderness and tempted God in the desert. Numbers 11 and 5 describes what they craved. They craved the fish, which we used to eat free in Egypt, the cucumbers, the melons, the leek, the onions, the garlic. But now our appetite is gone. There is nothing at all to look at except this manna. And I guess they're feeling they didn't like the restrictions. But what did that bring with it? Being worked to death, walking in the clay. Verse 21, they forgot their Savior, who had done great things in Egypt, wonders in the land of Ham, and awesome things by the Red Sea. And verse 24, this is such an important verse, and maybe it's more important for me because, you know, on Wednesday night class, this is basically what we're looking at right now, that land that we're going to, and how the faithful of old are looking forward to that land. But it says, then they despised the pleasant land. They did not believe in his word, being God's word. They despised the pleasant land. They would rather go back than face what they saw as giants in the land. They claimed that, well, what about our children? What about our wives? It's not going to be safe. They didn't put their trust in God. And when you contrast that with as I said in Hebrews, and let's go there, with what Abraham did and the other worthies of old, it's black and white. Hebrews 11, verse 8. By faith, Abraham, when he was called, obeyed by going out to a place which he was to receive for an inheritance, and he went out, not knowing where he was going. By faith, he lived as an alien in the land of promise, as in a foreign land, dwelling in tents with Isaac and Jacob, fellow heirs of the same promise. For he was looking for the city which has foundations, whose architect and builder is God. God, the creator of heavens and earth, God who knows our frame, that we are but dust, God that knows what we could be at our potentially best. And he can bring us to that point. And it was rejected. And we compare Abraham, challenge he would have had, you know, one man, and versus this 2.5 million, and all the things that were going on in all the trials that were in Abraham's life versus all the trials that was. It's really hard to compare the two of them, but it looks like Abraham might have had, in my estimations, a tougher road to travel, or at least a more faith trying road to travel. And then we go down to verse 13, and it says, all these died in faith without receiving the promises, but having seen them and having welcomed them from a distance and having confessed that they were strangers and exiles on the earth. For those who say such things make it clear that they are seeking a country of their own. And indeed, if they had been thinking of that country from which they went out, they would have had opportunity to return. I guess the lesson for us this morning is that Israel returned. They returned in their mind. We have that same opportunity as well. But we come here on a regular basis to remember what was done for us, the wonderful works. And if we just flip to chapter 12 of Hebrews, it says that, and really this encapsulates the whole talk this morning, starting halfway through verse 1, lay aside every encumbrance and the sin which so easily entangles us, that being the miry clay, and let us run the race with endurance, the race that is set before us, fixing our eyes on Jesus, the author and perfecter of faith, who for the joy set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and has sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. It was the joy of that, of what was set before him. The thing that Israel rejected as they were attempted to come into the promised land the first time. I'm going to end off with two readings back to Psalm 40, verse 5 is very wonderful as well. Many, O Lord, my God, are the wonders which thou hast done, and thy thoughts toward us. There is none to compare with thee. If I would declare and speak of them, they would be too numerous to count. And those are the things that we think about this morning. And finally, Psalm 18 and 2 reads, the Lord is my rock and my fortress and my deliverer, my God, my strength, in whom I will trust.